ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm science reporter Fiona Pepper.
And I'm Dr. Carl.
73 seconds after launch, something unthinkable happened to the Space Shuttle Challenger.
Obviously a major malfunction.
We could not believe what we were seeing. The Challenger Legacy.
Join us as we uncover what really happened.
Listen now by searching Science Friction on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
Government is always formed in the sensible centre, but our Liberal Party reflects a range of views.
Politics is the brutal game of arithmetic, but no one's going to vote for you if you don't stand for something.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney. And PK, much of the country is sweltering through this heat wave. I know you've had some brutally hot weather in Melbourne. But you know what, PK? I think the Bureau's made a mistake because I looked at the forecast for Canberra next week and it says it's very hot in Canberra right now, but it says things are cooling off. I don't know about you, but I reckon we could be in for a boil over in the national capital when the pollies get back on Monday.
I think that's right.
Thanks for laughing at my joke. Well,
I often do. Come on. Like, you're a pretty funny lady. Look, this is the situation we're in. Susan Lee's leadership has remained what you'd have to politely call an open question throughout the week.
I love that.
It's a polite open question. It's, you know, under question. Not an official spill yet, but yet is the key word there. Now, David Littleproud is facing a challenge of his own after the Queensland backbencher Colin Boyce issued a challenge, and now there will be a vote. There are questions, though, about how serious that is. I mean, he's trying something on Colin Boyce, but will it work? And so we're going to dig into all these things in terms of how both party rooms will respond, because next week is going to be huge and the coalition is still split. Like, the parliament will return. And unless there's a miracle over the next couple of days, and I can't see the pathway, in fact, I'm pretty certain there isn't one, we are going to have a parliament returning with a split coalition.
Mm. And we'll get to what that's going to actually physically look like in the chamber too, because that's something else. PK, last week we forecast this. We suggested that, you know, Susan, this was not just all the pressure last week was talked about in terms of Susan Lee's leadership, but, you know, both you and I suggested this was going to be a challenge for Littleproud too, because this idea of the coalition splitting is not popular. I mean, that's what Colin Boyce is all about, and there's plenty in the Nats party room who know they can't win. In fact, they'll lose big time if the coalition doesn't get back together in time for the next election. So that's what's happened. But we also spoke about the rise of the right in Australia. You know, One Nation was rocketing up the polls. There's that increasingly vocal base was on public display this week with March for Australia rallies right across the country on Australia Day. They weren't huge, some of them, but they were noisy and they were angry. And in some cases, people attending them stepped over the line of the law. We also saw Pauline Hanson in demand. She was at one of those rallies in Brisbane. She was also the first guest on Carl Stefanovic's new podcast. So that's a well-worn path these days for leaders to, you know, boost their numbers and get more attention. She went on Kyle and Jackie O. She bobbed up in the corridors of Parliament House. So I think what that translates to is she's being taken more and more seriously, as I guess her party's polling should demand. So we're going to take a look at what's going on here electorally, and could One Nation start winning federal seats at the next election? How's that going to look in a couple of years' time?
Let's just also let people know that while all the infighting has given the government what I think is a breather, like, you know, almost time for the PM to get to Copacabana kind of level, that's where his beach house is, because the coalition are literally eating their young. The economy, though, doesn't stop. And this week's inflation figures, much higher than expected, means a rate rise is likely next week. And that really spells enormous trouble for the government. So let's bring in Mel Clark. She's Radio National's political correspondent, a great friend of the show. She, of course, co-hosted the show while we were both away last year now. Can you believe that was last year? Oh, Lordy. Mel, welcome to the party room.
Thanks for having me back. I'm very ready for 2026 party room discussions.
Mel, I think we can call you the best friend of this podcast.
That's a coveted title. I'm very pleased to have that.
You know, last week we suggested this split in the coalition was going to mean pressure on both coalition leaders, not just Susan Lee. On Wednesday, the Nats fulfilled that prophecy. Backbencher Colin Boyce went on Sky News and issued a leadership challenge to David Littleproud. I don't think anyone saw that coming. Well, at least they're all saying they never saw that coming. And today, we're recording this on Thursday, on Radio National Breakfast, Colin Boyce had conceded he hadn't canvassed any numbers yet.
How can you want to be leader if you're not seeking support?
Look, I came out yesterday and made this announcement, and the reasons for that were simple: to allow my colleagues 4 or 5 days to contemplate the future. I'm not aware of anybody else that is intending to run for leadership. Having said that, that is a distinct possibility.
Let's start there. How real is this threat from Colin Boyce to David Littleproud's leadership? Nobody that I've heard or spoken to seems to think Colin Boyce is actually leadership material. In fact, all the talk until now has been that he might follow Barnaby Joyce to One Nation. So, Mel, what is this really about?
Well, there's a lot going on there. Let's go to the second part first, the idea that he's on the cusp of going to One Nation, which I think has been talked about in the corridors of Canberra for months, if not longer, which he does clearly rule out. And I think in that interview this morning, he was quite definitive and perhaps very open about the fact that if you were to run for a lower house seat with One Nation, it's pretty much impossible to remain in Parliament.
No, that's not an option I'm considering. And, you know, it's simple political mathematics. It's extremely difficult to win a lower house seat if you were going to run for One Nation. You can only ask that question to both Pauline Hanson and Barnaby Joyce. Why don't they run for lower house seats? And I can answer that for you, because it's a lot easier to win a Senate position and get, you know, a bit over 14% of the vote across the state.
Which I think is very clearly flagging what a lot of politicians focus on, but usually pretend is not the point. Normally, if you talk about what party you might want to run for a seat with, you'd talk about policies. But no, Colin was very upfront that you don't get a seat if you run for One Nation in the lower house. So I think that gave us the answer up front from Colin Boyce. He's not looking to move because his prospects of hanging on to his seat wouldn't be very good. It just normally comes with a bit more of a veneer of, well, this is the policy position.
I get what you mean, Mel, but I do want to add to that. If you look at Colin Boyce, who I interviewed in the 22 election and basically was like, you know, against net zero from then on the record, and it kind of became quite a yarn. That's because this guy has been backing a lot of One Nation style policies for a long time. So I don't think he thinks there is any difference. But anyway, that's just an aside. Like, I don't think the policy worries him so much because everything he's fought for, he wins.
Good point.
Indeed, he's managed to be part of the move to help shift the Nationals' positions to those views that he have. But the question does very rightly remain, Fran, as you say, on what is he doing? Because he's very clear that he hasn't been canvassing the numbers for the leadership. And if you were to seriously undertake a move to spill the leadership with the intention of trying to have that position for yourself, of course you're going to do that groundwork. You wouldn't be taking your colleagues by surprise, which many of them have made it very clear they were not expecting this, and that their support remains with David Littleproud. So I think we only need to go to recent history to see the role that these kind of unexpected moves and what the motives can be. I mean, immediately made me think of Simon Crean back in the Gillard government when there was a bit of a push internally to try and reinstall Kevin Rudd in the prime ministership, and it just sort of got stuck in a bit of stalemate.
It made me think about when Kevin Andrews did it.
Yes.
The coalition. When was that, 2009?
2009, when Malcolm Turnbull was the opposition leader. And I think they're both really good examples, but slightly different, because when it was Simon Crean, he was a bit of a freelancer. He hadn't been had authority, but it didn't go anywhere because it wasn't organised. He was just becoming frustrated with the lack of progress and wanted to shake things up and thought he could kick off that momentum. It kind of fizzled. But you know, ultimately Kevin Rudd later on did succeed in taking over. Whereas Kevin Andrews was clearly a stalking horse for Tony Abbott. And whilst it was unsuccessful in terms of spilling Malcolm Turnbull for the leadership, it exposed that Malcolm Turnbull's level of support within the party was only very narrowly in the majority. And a couple of days later, there was another spill and that was successful. And then Tony Abbott succeeded. So I guess the point here is he's clearly trying to create some kind of momentum. Whether or not he thought he's authorised to do that on behalf of someone else, the someone else is likely to be a Matt Canavan because he's the one that put his hand up after the 2025 election where they have an automatic spill.
He reckons he had no idea Colin Boyce was going to do this.
And I think that's a convincing case from Matt Canavan. He's been quite consistent in asserting that, and his actions certainly don't suggest otherwise. Colin Boyce is certainly quite capable of making manoeuvrings of his own without it being at the direction of someone else. I think if there was a grand strategy here, then Matt Canavan probably would have done a better job of lining up allies. And from a pretty wide canvassing of Nationals MPs and senators, they're not lining there to help support the spill.
Sure. But what it does do is destabilise David Littleproud's leadership. It doesn't matter if it works or not. It's still plays that role, and those examples you've both given actually are the perfect examples for how it still did that, right? Yes.
Yes.
Neither of those cases necessarily led to the outcome, but, you know, they led to the terminal nature of the leadership of those leaders. And so David Littleproud's leadership is beyond shaky ground. And one of the points that Colin Boyce makes actually was a really good one, which is why would the Liberals want to do a deal with David Littleproud again? And I think that's right. And I think that's right because I have had senior Liberals, including Conservatives, and I mention that because, you know, Susan Lee's a moderate and you'd think, oh, okay, that's why, you know, that's why the issue is happening. No, the Conservatives are likely to actually flex their muscle from my conversations even more than the moderates in some ways, not because they want different positions. They might align often with the Nationals, but they don't like being told what to do. And they're a bit sick of, you know, the tanties, and they're going to be, and I think James Patterson was clear on RN Breakfast about that kind of arrangement. Like, you can't be just breaking shadow cabinet solidarity. And so I think actually David Littleproud, even if he survives next week, and he may, in fact, at this point, we'd have to say he probably will, as a leader, I think he's kind of, I don't know, his days are numbered in terms of his usefulness, aren't they?
Well, also because he's the one, to quote Colin Boyce again, who's taken the coalition over a cliff. And Colin Boyce, what it's about is Colin Boyce, as you say, doing the numbers, it's all about the arithmetic, can see, and others can see that they're just hopeless electorally without being in coalition with the Liberals. So who wants to be in coalition with the Liberals? Nearly all of them do, but who do we know in the senior ranks? We do know that Michael McCormick does. We do, former leader. We do know that Matt Canavan does. And, you know, he's a significant contender. So that's what it's all about. That is what will focus the mind perhaps when they get in the party room.
I think you're exactly right. What Colin Boyce is seeing is something that all of the Nationals know, which is their best prospects of electoral success is in coalition if they want to have joint tickets with the Liberals in Senate seats, particularly in Victoria and New South Wales. They would have little chance of getting a Senate quota on their own. If they don't want to face three-cornered contests and make it more competitive in some seats that they can count on if they are not competing against the Liberals, then they need to be back in coalition. Colin Boyce is clearly looking at the situation, not satisfied that there's any kind of momentum or shift that will bring about that reunification, and he's trying to push to make something happen.
And it will happen. I mean, they will get back in coalition, or they're corked. Meanwhile, they are the junior party in the coalition, even though, you know, it's often said that they've been the tail wagging the dog in there. And the focus is still really, I think, the major focus on the leadership tensions in the Liberal room. Liberals have been backgrounding for weeks. PK, you were reading out texts as we were recording last week of what people were saying, suggesting Susan Lee won't last as leader. We know the two other contenders, Angus Taylor and Andrew Hastie, both from the Conservative wing of the Liberal Party, are being urged to sort it out between themselves and come up with one challenger, agree which of them will step forward. Now, that's not easy to do. We know both have ambition. We're recording this on Thursday. As I said, it's reported they're going to meet face-to-face today in Melbourne. Are the Libs about to toss their leader to PK? Could we start the next question time this week, next week, with two new faces at the dispatch box?
We could.
What do you reckon?
We could, but there is – those numbers have not firmed yet, and I'll explain. Because the right is split over its two candidates and they can't come together, and we've seen the interventions – which some people roll their eyes about internally, let me tell you, of Tony Abbott and others saying, you've got to come to a deal to get rid of Susan Lee, he's privately told all his colleagues. Okay, sure. Andrew Hastie, he's not about to abandon his ambitions. He's not about to play, you know, second fiddle to Angus Taylor. Angus Taylor is pitching himself internally as a much more consensus kind of candidate in a weird kind of way, like, not as hard edge, not as radical perhaps as an Andrew Hastie. Now the party's going to have to make a decision about, and firstly that starts in the right, about whether they want that more radical approach. Now I know Labor people who think that that more radical approach of an Andrew Hastie actually might be a bigger game changer. Like they're a bit more worried about that approach rather than a steady as she goes traditional Liberal version of doing it. Right now though, you have to have a spill motion with 50 plus one, right, of the party room, and there are not enough votes for a spill motion. So they are likely to start the week with Susan Lee, I think, unless they can get those numbers for a spill motion. And it's just not about to happen. Like, is that your read, Mel? I just don't see the numbers for a spill motion at this stage on a Thursday.
Yeah, at this stage, it's not coordinated enough. And I think we just have to look back at the post-election period where the Conservatives' efforts to take the leadership sort of hit the skids when it came to the actual process in the room. You'll remember Jacinta Numpa-Jimpa Price was lined up to put a hand up as deputy to Angus Taylor, but then when that didn't really work out and she didn't put her name forward, and it was all in a bit of disarray. And I think there is a bit of scarring from that process last time, and the Conservatives are determined that if they move that they have it done neatly, tied up with a pretty bow on top to avoid that kind of mess again. But historically, I think we usually see that these sorts of leadership transitions rarely go as neatly and as cleanly as anyone wants. And whilst everything at the moment suggests Susan Lee will have to start the parliamentary sitting fortnight, still as leader, we'll have to figure out some kind of interim arrangement for the front bench as these things still kick away. It's looking like a very difficult fortnight for her, because even if she remains in the leadership position, the question of leadership is not resolved.
And I just want to take a bit of a detour here, because one reason why I think even though these two conservative wannabes a meeting today, I don't think we're going to get a rupture today. I don't think there'll be an announcement, because the Libs are paying respect to a former colleague, Katie Allen. She was the member for Higgins and lost the election before last. She was a highly regarded colleague because she was a moderate, but she was a moderate with a voice. Susan Lee has paid tribute to her. She said, as a woman in public life, Katie led by example. She showed that strength and kindness weren't opposites, that leadership could be both principled and humane, and that conviction need not veer towards cruelty. And she had a run at Chisholm last election and lost that. But the thing about Katie Allen is that she was highly regarded. She was a paediatrician. On a number of occasions, she stood up in her party room and in the parliament and voted against the coalition's positions, most notably when she voted against the religious discrimination bill in 2022. She felt so strongly as a paediatrician that there should be laws against vilifying children based on gender identity and sexuality. Trans kids, basically, was what it was about. That's just one of the things. Though she has joked since. She called herself the Pauline Hanson of the moderates, but she also said she remained quiet too often when she should have spoken up. That's a really big thing to admit. And it strikes me that, you know, I wonder if some of the Liberals who will be attending her funeral, having heard and seen that regret from Katie Allen that she didn't speak up enough, whether it might influence some of her former Modric colleagues to start being more independent and a little bit braver in the positions they take in their party room, because they've been accused from some former Liberals and former Liberal staffers of being too often National Party light, and that this is not the way for electoral success for the Liberal Party. So I just wonder whether that might be in their minds when they sit down at the funeral today.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Fran. And she was a really strong woman in the parliament, and I think that just a big loss, I think, just generally to the world, but obviously for the Liberal Party, I think they'll be feeling the weight of her loss pretty strongly today. Look, Parliament, as we say, is returning next week, and while Susan Lee has reportedly written to David Littleproud in an attempt to meet ahead of next week, he has rejected that now. There's lots of briefing on this, isn't there, Mel, about was it a rejection or not, or was she trying to embarrass him by saying that she's, you know, willing to have this meeting? He's focused on the spill. Like, where do you line up on this one, Mel?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of competing spinning going on here. You know, the Susan Lee camp is, look, the Nationals can't even get organised enough to have a no conditions meeting before Parliament resumes next week. There's a bit of the spin on the Nationals side is, well, Susan Lee deliberately did this once she knew the Colin Boyce challenge was happening and that there's no way he'd be able to take that meeting. But then there's different views from other Nationals about that. So it's one of those things where, you know, letters are sent. More people know about them before they seem to land in the inboxes of the intended recipient. So there's certainly a lot of manoeuvring going on. But look, there really does need to be some kind of detente or at least some discussion, because they need to figure out some really logistical things ahead of Parliament returning. Who's sitting where? Are we having acting people in portfolios? How are committees going to work? Are we going to reallocate memberships of committees based on being separate? These are all real logistical things that affect the running of the parliament that isn't clear at this point.
Sure. And meanwhile, you know, they return and they're all of them looking at the rise of the right, as we've spoken about previously. And that was writ large at Australia Day. We had all those March for Australia anti-immigration rallies. Pauline Hanson was at one of those rallies. One man was arrested in the Sydney rally for alleged hate speech. So is that the new laws in progress? And perhaps most seriously of all, police, the AFP, have arrested a man who threw what's been alleged to be a bomb into an Invasion Day rally, and the AFP are now officially looking at that as an alleged or a possible terrorist attack. And then we've got, you know, Pauline Hanson, as I said at the top, out and about on first guest on Karl Stefanovic's new podcast, speaking for 53 minutes. This is quite a platform. Where does this all fit into what we're seeing happening at the moment? And is that going to be the argument in that National Party room when they sit down on Monday about why they shouldn't rejoin the coalition because they see their enemy on the right?
I thought it was interesting that James Patterson, in speaking as a key Liberal Conservative voice who has been keeping his counsel, as many of the Liberal Conservatives have over the last few days, but he made a very pointed reference to Labor being the main political opponent. And I think that was a very big nudge to the Nationals to stop worrying about One Nation so much and focus on the Labor Party. That's the contest for the power of government. But there is no doubt that the increasing support that we're seeing for One Nation hangs over so much of what is happening here. And I do think it's coming with a cultural shift as well. I think when you see what One Nation as a political party have been able to do to make inroads on social media has been impressive for their adoption of various formats to reach more people. What started as a small series of animated videos has turned into a full feature-length movie, a super progressive movie, it's called, and that's become quite a cult phenomenon. It's led to Holly Valance, former Australian actor turned right-wing activist, putting out a hit song that's doing very well in the charts. One Nation have been able to very successfully use contemporary platforms to reach more people in a way that all political parties desire to do, but they've actually been very effective in leveraging growing interest in their policies and turning that into products and content online that is reaching more people.
Mm. I mean, obviously, One Nation is really eating the territory of the Nationals, particularly. Mm. That's clear. And, you know, there's been a lot of discussion. There was a question last week to us, for instance, about whether they kind of go into coalition or whatever. It's been pointed out by lots of smart people that actually they're fighting for the same votes. So it's not like the reason the Libs and the Nationals were historically, and things are changing, a good coalition was, you know, the Nats did the regions, the Libs did the cities, and then they could come together, right, and in this broad church, whereas it's a bit different when you're competing for the same votes. I think Pauline Hanson has fought pretty hard for this party over 30 years. I don't think she'll be wanting to do any merging in any hurry. I've never seen any evidence of that, especially after she got Barnaby Joyce across and perhaps other star recruits. But if you look at sort of what's happening so far with One Nation, what I can tell you is that Labor is watching it very closely for obvious reasons. They watch everything closely, but they're also looking to see whether the UK reform model, which is obviously, you know, taking so many Tories across to them as the populist right party now, will be replicated here. Their view at this stage is that while, for instance, in the Hunter, there's maybe a bit of a move on, and there has been if you look at the vote of One Nation to perhaps steal a seat off Labor, maybe in that region, but more broadly, One Nation's taking votes from the right in Australia at this stage, not the left.
And just on that, I mean, I was struck by that comment from Jason Falinski on Breakfast earlier in the week. He's a, you know, former Liberal MP. I think he's state president. I forget what they call him. He just sort of laid it out there and said, how big a threat is One Nation actually? What seats can they win?
Because it gets reported breathlessly because that's what One Nation wants to happen. But when actually people take a step back and look at the facts, even Barnaby Joyce doesn't want to run in his current seat of New England and will be running in the Senate. And there's a reason for that, and that is he knows that he is highly unlikely and won't win the seat of New England as the One Nation candidate. I can't even think of a seat that they're going to win in the lower house. Now, I'm happy
I mean,
to
that's
told that I'm wrong.
The question, isn't it? Comes back, as we said before, here. It always comes back to arithmetic. Why is anyone going to swap over there? Because what seats can they win? Now, you mentioned Hunter, but that's one.
Yeah, and there's still a big gulf between, I mean, it came down to, you know, the final two in Hunter was Labor and One Nation, but there was still quite a big gulf between the two.
Yeah, but that was the last election, right? That's the thing.
Yeah.
Sure. But things are different now, that's for sure.
But the One Nation strategy also has been that you run in lower house seats because that gets you attention, and ultimately it's more likely to help them pick up more Senate seats. And they are definitely close to winning more Senate seats, even based on where they were at the last election. So if we look at the polling now, they're in a good opportunity, if they're able to replicate this level of support come the next election, to pick up more Senate seats. It's very hard with our political system of compulsory voting and preferential voting to see how you can make big inroads in the lower house at this point. But what I found really interesting is among this online culture that does look to what reform is doing in the UK, that looks at US politics, and I think you see on a lot of the commentary on the social media pages of these politicians, which is very active at the moment, by the way, a lot of the Nationals are getting hammered about why they're not joining One Nation or why they're not merging, is there's lots of references to why don't we have a first past the post system like the UK. And that's actually something that in the online discussion has quite a bit of traction. Yes. Of why don't we move to a system like that. But it's not a debate that's happening in the mainstream political discussion. And I think we're increasingly seeing that divide of discussions that are happening politically in an online space, and they're quite different from the discussions that are being had in mainstream media and mainstream political circles. And there's a risk that if one half isn't really familiar with what the other half is doing, the nation's having totally different conversations.
Yeah, that's right. Look, we must go to what I think is the most significant story. I mean, I'm not saying that the right wing of politics isn't interesting or significant, but, you know, for every Australian, yesterday, I reckon most people would have gone, what, on those inflation figures. So inflation rose to a massive 3.8% in December. That's hotter than forecast by most economists, up from 3.4% in November. That is clearly outside the RBA's target band. That means only one thing, Mel. A rate hike is very much on the agenda for next week. Now, of course, the RBA is independent and makes decisions based on what's best for our economy, not what's best for politicians. But, you know, that will be watched by, you know, it'll happen and it'll be delivered in live time, in question time, you know. And the Treasurer already seems gloomy. Like, this is not good. This is a, you know, stubborn inflation problem we have in this country.
It was certainly foreseeable, but Labor was very keen to show at the last election that the work that had been done in bringing inflation down, but clearly the work still needs to be done.
There are some persistent price pressures in our economy. We've been upfront about that. And if you look at today's data, some of it is temporary, some of it is more persistent. None of it can be attributed to the budget settings. In fact, we've improved the budget at every budget update since we've come to office. The increase in inflation today was primarily driven
for Jim Chalmers. This is particularly a bitter pill to swallow, not just for the immediate impact that it has on anyone sweating on their mortgage payments being able to come down further and now looking at them going up, but also he has big intentions for this budget. This will be the forthcoming budget, will be the first budget in the second term of the government. This is his best opportunity to talk about significant reform. What form that might take, we'll have to see. But the idea that there might be changes to broader changes to things like income tax and company tax certainly have had plenty of discussion in the economic roundtable. It is going to be so much harder to make the case for major economic and fiscal reform if people are sweating about being able to pay their bills tomorrow. So his ambition and desire to have a solid case for reform gets harder as inflation continues to stick around.
Yeah, because it's a massive pressure on governments. I mean, you called it a massive number, PK 3.8. Jim Chalmers is desperately trying to remind us that inflation had got to 7.8, right? It was 6.8, I think, when they were elected initially. So he wants to say, hey, we brought it down. You know, the proof is before our very eyes. These rate decisions have a political impact. You know, just before the last election, the RBA, just a few weeks before, cut rates for the first time in 4 years. That was a huge boost to Anthony Albanese and the nation's sentiment towards Labor and their government, I think. And the government certainly can't rest easy, even though the coalition's ripping itself apart, as long as rates are going up, just like you said.
Yeah, and the government's basically, you know, they've just been gifted the implosion of the coalition. That's a great opportunity for their economic team. And I'm not saying they don't work hard, they do, but like to really kind of double down into what on earth is the strategy to get us out of this, right? Because inflation is not a small thing. It's not just a political issue. It is absolutely a killer for people and for poor people too, right? Like, don't forget that. Like, inflation, when it's baked into the economy like this, has such an enormously negative impact on people. And unless you can break the back of it.
Because your bread, your milk, everything costs more.
It's just, and it's pervasive. It just doesn't, you know, there's no sort of light at the end of the tunnel if it's stuck. And so they have to get pretty serious about how to tackle it, which is going to mean some tough decisions that we're not all going to love.
Yep.
They have this great breathing room, don't they, Mel? I see it as this breathing space. While the coalition implodes, they can come up with something good, Mel.
They can, but you should never rely on the fallibility of your opponents to help you chart your course in politics, I think. Things can shift so quickly, and we've seen that over the last 2 months.
That's why they need to do it. That's my point. Yeah. Like, take this chance, because the other guys are too busy talking about themselves. Like, the best line I heard this morning, can I say, was when Kevin Hogan said on RN that, you know, he would much rather prefer to be talking about inflation and the fact that interest rates are going up next week, and it was the but that got me. I thought, I would much rather, would you? Because you could be. You know what I mean? Like, Fran, am I right?
Well, that's right. And actually, I mean, there's plenty of former Libs are telling the Liberal Party, if they just started talking about the economy more and the cost of living and actually got some policies that people could relate to, then that's when you start winning government, right? So the same goes for the Nats. They've got to start talking about the economy. They've got to stop talking about themselves. And on that note, Mel, have a good week. It's going to be a lot going on there. And thanks for giving us your time. We love having you here.
Thanks, Fran. As you say, the temperature outside might be cooling down in Canberra next week, but in Parliament House, it's definitely going to be staying red hot.
And Fran, that's it for the Party Room this week. There has been so much to unpack that we've run out of time for question time, but keep sending your questions in because we love getting them. We'll do a special episode where we try and answer lots of them. We love to do that. Just send them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
Yeah, we do. We feel bad when we can't fit in the questions because they're so good, but we will get to them. Remember, follow Politics Now on the ABC Listen app. That's the feed where you find this Party Room podcast. You'll never miss an episode that way.
You never do, and that's the thing you want to do. You don't want to miss things. How terrible. I hate it when I miss things. We'll be back in your feed for a special bonus episode of Politics Now on Saturday with ABC reporter Claudia Long joining me to try to get to the bottom of where the government is in its action against family violence. We're going to tackle what promises have been made and what the government might focus on this year. See you, Fran.
See you, PK.